It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a generation growing up with social media loves it and hates it. And they're having a hard time being as happy offline as they look online. We'll meet the author of the book, The Happiness Effect. First, schools in Wisconsin are starting a new year, and music class is a part of most school curricula. It might conjure up similar memories for a lot of us, learning scales, playing the recorder, or singing some classic songs in choir. Our next guest says in order to keep music education meaningful and engaging for students, it needs an update. That involves meeting kids where they're at by including more genres of music and rethinking the way they get taught. Lee Whitmore is the executive director of the Grammy Music Education Coalition. His recent report for the Hechinger Report is called What's Missing in Music Education, Cultural and Social Relevance. Lee, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
Before we dig into how we do music education and the changes we're looking for, let's start with the why. However we teach it, you, it sounds like, are a big fan of music education.
I am. In fact, it changed me when I was young. I had a father who worked for the Army, and we traveled. He did that for 23 years. I counted more than a dozen schools by the time, public schools, by the time I got to high school. So me, as an introverted young person, finding the music room, a music teacher when I got to a new school was super important.
And talk about it for kids in general. What's the value of getting that music education in school?
Well, it changes everything in life for kids, for their families, for communities. And, you know, I'll reference a piece of research that I like to talk about often. I can tell you music has this incredible power to benefit young people in so many different ways. There's a researcher at Northwestern University. Her name is Nina Krauss, and she's a brain researcher, not a music researcher, but music is connected in the arts to what she looks at. And she and her team have literally proven that for young people, 5 hours or more a week of active making music, not just access, not just listening, but making and creating, 5 hours or more a week for two or more years as an adolescent permanently changes the biology of a young person's brain. And it has lasting effects. It sustains. So social and emotional outcomes, community, conversation, ability to communicate, and all kinds of other things. Not to mention it increases participation for young people, for students in school. And there's a whole host of other things that go along with that.
A lot of people have gone through a similar experience. I did it. My kids have done it. You know, some singing maybe in elementary school, some general music appreciation, then maybe band class or you split off to choir, strings if your school has that. You were a music teacher yourself, and you ran into situations where you felt like that, we'll call it traditional model of music education, was falling short for some of your students. Talk about that story.
Yeah, and by the way, I want to mention that my piece in the Hechinger Report and my position here is that all kinds of music connection and education and music making for kids, for young people, is super important. The relevancy part, though, is something we really need to pay attention to. From my perspective, you know, I'm, as you mentioned at the top of the conversation, the executive director for the Grammy Music Education Coalition, and we have one goal, and that's every student in the United States not just having access, but actively making music. And, you know, for a music teacher, I did struggle coming out of undergraduate school with my pre-service training and my license. If you don't have the tools, the equipment, the experience, so to speak, to engage kids where they're at, and remember, young people are, everybody's different, whether it's an urban center, in a rural community, in the world or the country's largest public school system in New York or the second largest in LA, kids come from different cultural backgrounds. They have different experiences. And you know what? A good teacher can bring kids in and teach them anything, but it's getting them in the door and keeping them there that's so important. So band, choir, orchestra, I play trombone in the marching band. I'm a pianist, a keyboard player, a technologist. I play Mozart. You know, I was sitting here after watching the Elton John movie the other day in my apartment playing a digital piano with some Elton tunes, which I grew up with. It doesn't matter what it is. As long as it's engaging, it captures kids' hearts and minds. And then a great teacher can do so much with that interest.
Talking to Lee Whitmore from the Grammy Music Education Coalition, he says we need to change our music education, broaden it out, and make it more culturally and socially relevant to kids. Lee, in your piece, you give some examples. You also sent us some videos. Can you talk about what some of the things are out there that schools are trying to meet kids where they are?
Well, could be instrumental music, could be vocal, could be technology. I'll give you, as you mentioned, a couple of examples. Two of the city markets, our inaugural markets for the Grammy Music Education Coalition, are the Metro Nashville Public Schools and the Philadelphia School District of Philadelphia. And our model, when we work with school systems, is to make sure that first and foremost, with our philanthropy and our outreach, we're getting to kids that are most in need, underserved kids in Title I schools, families that qualify for free and reduced lunch. And our work in Philly and Nashville, where we're approaching those kids, are done in different ways. Our model is to go to community school systems, listen to teachers, listen to community, learn about the culture of kids, and then figure out what the right matches are. We don't prescribe what that music teaching should be. We help fund it, and we work with the experts in the school systems. School District of Philadelphia is a really interesting one. I'll just share a generalization. It's not the case for every school system, but pretty much in the United States, we're a relatively wealthy country, and there's a lot of access for music education in public schools. You know, there's about 74 million public age school students, and more than 51 of them are school age kids, rather, and 51 million are in public schools. There's 100,000 or more music teachers that are trained in teaching in schools. What's important is connecting to things in a district that make a difference and keep kids in. There's a high participation in the requirements for this in your state and many for kids to participate in music as elementary school students. But then something happens. They get to secondary, meaning they get to middle, and it's not that often they make a choice, they have to make a choice. And then when they get to high school, they have to make a choice again. Is it music? Is it something else? In Philly, what we've done to encourage kids, students at middle and high school to stay in is we're funding a service provider program. It's really pretty amazing. The program is called DASH, Destined to Achieve Successful Heights. It's our first substantial investment in that school system in our first grant-making year. And what DASH does is it's run by a Live Nation urban executive. It's run by a national trustee of the Recording Academy, the Grammys, and others. They go in, mentor kids, and the focus is on commercial music. So what they're doing is providing skills around music, songwriting, playing instruments, recording, and guess what? They're creating a district-wide label, and the students will run it, a record label. They'll create music of whatever in any genre, but imagine mentoring with a Grammy-winning producer. His name is Ivan Barrios, who's a Recording Academy trustee, elected to another term as a national trustee, and to work with somebody from Live Nation and to learn about marketing. And it's really quite incredible. I'll actually see some of those students tomorrow. I'm making a trip to Philadelphia where we're working with Corinne Bailey-Ray, who is a Grammy winner, and she's going to spend time with about 30 students from the Philadelphia school system, some of which are in that program that I just described.
And you also mentioned Nashville. It sounds like one size doesn't fit all in this program, so what kind of unique things are happening in Nashville?
So Nashville's approach, and again, we listen to the school systems, you know, our clients and our work are the kids or students, and our partners in getting the work done to the public school systems. In Nashville, there's fantastic leadership. Dr. David Williams is the chief academic officer of the district, and Jeff Smith is the visual and performing arts director. What they've asked us to do is help to fund effective teacher development. You mentioned in my story in the Hechinger Report, I share how when I was dropped into a public school classroom as a student teacher with kids that had learning and emotional challenges, I was pretty terrified about that. In public school systems, particularly in underserved districts, there's a great amount of teacher turnover, attrition. And so what the district in Nashville, the Metro Nashville Public Schools, has asked us to do is to help fund coaches. So for the first time, there are coaches, by the way, in other subject matter areas in that school district that make a really big difference in student attendance, participation, and academic outcomes and success. For the first time, thanks to a collaboration between the Grammy Music Education Coalition and the Metro Nashville Schools, there are two, an elementary and a secondary music coach. They're experienced classroom teachers that have moved on to help coach the many, many certified music teachers in the Metro Nashville Schools. It's pretty exciting.
We're talking with Lee Whitmore, Executive Director of the Grammy Music Education Coalition, about rethinking the way we teach music in our schools. We want to hear from you. Do you wish your time in music class was more engaging or relevant? If you're a music teacher, do you work with the music your students actually listen to? Do you have the freedom to get creative with your class? If you're a musician, do you think back to your schooling with getting you where you are now? Tweet us at Central Time WPR with your thoughts. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we pick up our conversation with Lee Whitmore, director of the Grammy Music Education Coalition, about making music classes more relevant for students. And we want to hear from you. Do you think that music class needs an update? What would you have changed about your music education? If you're a music teacher, we'd love to hear about your experience. How do you make class relevant to your students? If you're a parent, what would help your kids stay excited about music in school and beyond? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know. Scott joins us in Windsor. Scott, hi.
Hey. I'm happy to hear this program. I just wanted to relate an experience that my daughter and I, our family, experienced. She was in second grade at our local elementary school, and the PTA financed an artist in residence. And, well, it's all right, fine. The student population is 99% white, and this fellow, Leota Stanley, I highly recommend him. Firefighter by day, jazz musician by night. He came in as an artist in residence, and he worked with those kids through the spring, and then came time for the spring recital. I have never been so thrilled to see these kids in a musical performance. Every one of them had a chance to solo. They wanted that mic. They were loving every minute of it. But you flash forward 2 years, Leota Stanley is gone, and they have, and these kids are stock still. They were told not to sway, and they barely smiled through the whole thing. Somehow or another, we grind that love of music out of our kids, and we've got to stop that.
Interesting, Scott. Thank you so much for sharing that before and after. What do you think of that story, Lee?
I think it resonates with me. You know, our coalition is a group of more than 70 affiliate organizations, and many do provide artist-in-residence programs. We just talked about Nashville, the Metro Nashville Public Schools, where there's a very active structure in place. And you can imagine Nashville being the music city with so much recording. There's many artists and producers, folks from the producers and engineering wing at the Recording Academy that want to help. The itinerant nature of programs is something that's always to be focused on. And one of the things that we do as an organization is we work to help support a strategic plan with the district. So whether it's, you know, something that's happening with an artist in residence after school, before school, on the weekends, working with out-of-school time organizations that can help to make sure that there's long-term support for programs with kids. The story really resonated. You know, Scott talked about the difference it made, all the kids up on stage performing. It's amazing when you have a chance to see examples like that. And we have some up on our Instagram page, Facebook page, and on our YouTube channel as well.
Thanks, Scott, for the call. We'll go to Angie in Oconomowoc now. Angie, hi.
Hi. Sounds like you've got a great program. I didn't hear all of what Scott said. I've been teaching in Lake Mills for over 20 years, and my high school orchestra was at the point where I felt like we should concentrate on living composers for a year. So we took a year and met some different composers. We were able to Skype with someone who lives out in the Dakotas. My husband's a composer, so he came in and clinicked the group. And our ultimate project was we were able to commission a professor from Southern Illinois University, and he arranged a piece, a progressive rock song for the orchestra with specific guitar parts. The students, I think, really got a lot of talking to and Skyping with living composers and finding out, you know, what do those people do with the rest of their day, basically.
Angie, did the students approach the music differently after they actually talked to the person who wrote it?
Oh, I think so. I surveyed them just to see exactly that, and they made connections with the composers I wasn't expecting. Generational differences and all kinds of things kind of floated away. It was really cool. This year, kind of continuing that, my middle schoolers even figured it out. The emphasis on living composers was different styles of music. So this year I'm concentrating on women composers, because there was only one woman that whole year, and composers of color, composers who are maybe LGBTQ, so basically underrepresented composers. And it's going to be, I think, a harder project, because trying to find that music is a little bit of a challenge. So I'm reaching out to area colleges, and if anyone out there wants to let me know, that'd be great.
Angie, thank you so much for that call. Angie, going the extra mile. Lee, I love this idea, and this fits in some of what you guys are doing with Philadelphia and Nashville. It's not just, hey, students, here's the sheet music. You're taking people behind the scenes and how music is made, as Angie did.
And one of the things that really struck me, Rob, with Angie's comments were, you know, having that professional experience, that professional experience in that composer with students makes such a difference. What I find in my experience, and I've been out in classrooms for a couple decades now, is young people don't understand or have that interaction. They don't know that this is a potential career path for them or a potential avocational path for them. Music is there, composing, writing, engineering, creating music for video games. It could be any number of things. Love that story.
Thank you so much
anecdote.
Thanks for sharing that, Angie. We're talking about music education and what can be done to maybe refresh it, make it more vital for kids. Lee Whitmore is with us from the Grammy Music Education Coalition. Back to your calls now. Lori is with us in Wanakee. Lori, hi.
Hi. I just want to thank you for this focus today on cultural and social relevancy in music education through this interview with Lee. I'm the executive director of the Wisconsin School Music Association and Wisconsin Music Educators Association, and this is a national issue that needs to be at the forefront of every conversation we're having about music education for our kids.
And Lori, what do you and your organization, what kind of things are you trying to embrace that idea of making music education more relevant for kids?
This is actually a huge focus of our work this year. We just received a Country Music Association Foundation grant to actually look at the diversity, equity, and access in all of our, both our programming and our workforce. So we look forward to rolling up our sleeves this year and really looking at all of what is available to kids currently in Wisconsin and what needs to be available. We find it's very much teacher-centric right now. Teachers who are doing the great work that Lee is describing are out the gate, and those things are happening in those communities. But we need to find ways to connect teaching artists and our teachers so that kids around the state can have those experiences.
Lori, thanks so much for that call. Lee, yeah, it sounds like we could rely on individual initiative from teachers, but it sounds like Lori's looking for more something more structural, something more dedicated here.
And what her organization does is critical to that, and she has peered organizations in states around the country. Lori, I welcome any outreach to you. Happy to talk with you about your work and how we can work together. And congratulations on the Country Music Association Foundation grant. Rob, one thing I want to mention connected to the last two callers, I'll give you an example. We were talking about diversity, cultural diversity, gender diversity, music education, and careers. We have an underwriter, a Founders Circle sponsor in our opening capital campaign for organization, Harman. Harman International, which is JBL and a bunch of other music and audio brands. Some of your listeners may have Harman sound systems in their cars. Harman is helping us with an investment, a restricted investment. We're going to be developing with supportive recording academy leaders, trustees, the music and the production and engineering wing at the Recording Academy to create content to encourage young women to consider the wide breadth of potential career opportunities and avocational opportunities that music and audio bring. And that'll be something that, while I mentioned anecdotes of working in Nashville and Philadelphia right now, our work will grow over time. We're just about to cross the line into our third operating year, and we often work to develop programs with partners like we could with Lori's to make sure that we're providing resources to all kids in all states.
Let's bring on Lisa now in Pittsville. Lisa, hi.
Hi there. Hi, I've been an elementary music teacher for 27 years, and I've noticed that a lot of the conversation has been centered around secondary music, and I would just like to add that in the elementary levels, developmental appropriateness is just so important. Right now, we have so much push toward testing and toward data that sometimes music class is one of the last bastions of developmental appropriateness, and I think that's very important.
Lisa, thanks. Leah, I heard you kind of nodding along there.
Yeah, I completely agree, and I'm smiling a little bit. Of course, you, the listeners, Lisa can't see. I mentioned the challenge in American public schools where there's attrition by young people at the secondary level. We support, and our stated goals include 100% participation in elementary music, what Lisa mentioned about supporting developmental appropriateness is crucial. I happen to give a couple of examples from our inaugural school districts that have significant need in bolstering participation, and that's our goal, universal participation. Every public school student in the United States, not only having access, but making and creating music. Elementary is a part of that. And for us as an organization, a stated goal and a commitment from me and our board is every elementary school student benefiting from a standards-based, amazing music education as well. And thank you, Lisa, for what you've done as an educator in your school system.
Thanks for the call, Lisa. Leah, in our last minute, it sounds like part of the goal here is also just get more creative. That music class might be what we picture in a choir or a band or orchestra class. I think I've seen examples of rock band class or mariachi programs or percussion mm-hmm. ensembles. The sky's the limit, and schools can be innovative here.
Yeah, it can be anything. And as you mentioned, Rob, it could be choir, vocal music. It could be any traditional approach, as folks like me have been trained in when we got our music education degrees and our teaching license. But I'd encourage, there's so many interesting programs with culture, genres of music, technology. And, for us, and I say this often, me, the Grammy Music Education Coalition, is agnostic to genre and to technique as long as it's great standards-connected music education, and that we use those tools, whether it's mariachi, songwriting, vocal music, whatever it is, to draw kids in and keep them in programs. That's the goal.
Lee, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure, Rob. Thank you so much for the time. Really appreciate it.
Lee Whitmore is the Executive Director of the Grammy Music Education Coalition. He was with us to talk about the ways he thinks music classes could be more culturally and socially relevant for today's students. Coming up after the news, young people have a love-hate relationship with social media, and that's creating a lot of anxiety. We'll find out more with the author of the book, The Happiness Effect. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new report shows that the state conducted 90 investigations into the Wisconsin Veterans Home at King. We'll talk with a state lawmaker about what the probes found about the quality of care, staffing issues, and more. First, maybe this has happened to you. You open up a Facebook or Instagram post and see a picture from an old classmate or coworker. 45 minutes later, you look up to realize you've been sucked into a black hole of pictures of their beautiful new house or the awesome vacation they just took. Then you think something along the lines of, man, I wish my house looked that good, or when's the last time I was on a beach? Our next guest says that unhappy feeling you get is pretty common, and it's one that a whole generation of young people are contending with day in and day out. Donna Freitas is non-resident research associate at the University of Notre Dame's Center for the Study of Religion and Society. She's the author of multiple fiction and nonfiction books. Out in paperback this month, her latest nonfiction is The Happiness Effect, How Social Media is Driving a Generation to Appear Perfect at Any Cost. Donna, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you started off writing a book about social media, and you realized pretty early on this is actually a book about happiness. How did that change?
Well, I actually only had one direct question that I asked all of my interview participants about happiness, and that was at the very end of the interview. But what I found was it didn't really matter what I asked college students about. If it had to do with social media or smartphones, part of their answer had to do with happiness.
And you, in writing this book, you talk to college students all over the country. This is based on, you have anecdotes of their stories of lots and lots of one-on-one conversations with actual students about their social media lives, right?
Yes, I traveled all over the country, and the interviews were done through random sampling. So these weren't college students who were like, pick me, I want to talk to you about social media. Like, these were students who I was like, please come do my interview. So so I think the data I have is very solid. And what just became very clear was that students kept bringing up happiness in all of their answers. And the thing that I noticed most, or that I found so interesting as I was going from interview to interview, was how they were talking about happiness. Because they weren't talking about how, oh, being on social media or being on Facebook or Instagram makes me so happy or it makes me unhappy. They were making a specific comment about real happiness versus the appearance of happiness. And they kept talking about how when you're online, when you're on social media, it's really important to appear happy. So much so that I had students saying things like, you know, online it's like a happiness competition. And I had students who made these sarcastic faces and comments where, you know, were like, oh, you have to go online and put on a happy face. And I just heard this all over the place, no matter where I went.
One of your interviewees said, here's a quote you shared in the book, people share the best versions of themselves, then we compare that to the worst versions of ourselves. So we're comparing our actual everyday lives to the ideal life that everybody else is portraying online.
Yeah, so I heard something like that from so many different students. And the student that you quoted was this student who I called Emma in the book. And she was really startling to me because she was, you know, like the queen bee on campus at her big Southern university. She was vice president of her sorority, and they were the top sorority on campus. And so she had, you know, the life that all the other women on campus envy. And here she was in this interview, and she was talking about how hard it was to go online all the time because it was such a hit to her self-esteem. And she said, I know everybody's lying. I know everybody is just pretending that they have this incredible, successful, amazing life and all of these friends, and they go to all these parties and they have a million boyfriends. And, you know, she went on and she said, I know that because I do that too. Like, I pretend just like everybody else. However, you know, when I pick up my phone or when I, you know, go on my laptop, you know, I'm still just me. And, you know, I'm having a bad hair day, or I'm feeling really lonely. And I keep telling myself these are all lies, but it doesn't change the fact that when I see so much success and perfection and happiness, that I feel really bad about myself.
And it seems like there's a lot of pressure to curate our online selves, sometimes with just one alternate version to our real lives. There's one college student you talked to who talked about how she had 17 different, Facebook groups. So, okay, this is for the people at church back home. This is for my fellow students. This is for, and so on and so on.
Yes, I remember that interview because I remember thinking, this sounds so exhausting.
Yeah.
But, you know, all of the students talked about, you know, their audiences, like plural, their publics, plural. They, you know, they talked about curating, crafting a post, an image for a specific audience. And, you know, I had students, quite a few students who talked to me about branding. And, you know, the first young woman who talked about this with me, she just came right out and she said, well, you know, my name is my brand. And I thought, is it really? So, but these students are getting from their teachers, from school, from college, from us too, from their parents, from their people in their lives who are mentoring them. We're teaching them that, you know, anything attached to your real name is is a big deal. Like, you have to be careful with it because, you know, online people can find out things about you. There are employers who may be looking at you, all sorts of people who are watching you. And so, you know, we've really instilled that idea into this generation. And so, you know, they talk about the importance of crafting every single post, the importance of really being careful, you know, who sees which post, because you never know what might happen. You have to be careful of your reputation. Like, I had a student who talked about what she told me was the reputation self. And, you know, that's the self that you have to, you know, curate online, because other people are going to evaluate you through it and you could ruin it very easily. And so, you know, I remember when I first got on Facebook a million years ago, when it was first on, because I was at a university and my students told me to open an account. So I did. And this was in the days when people put up everything. And I just remember thinking, I really didn't need to see any of this about my students. But now, you know, we've gone way in the other direction. And so you have a generation that is uber careful and who thinks about their posts almost like a kind of job.
Talking to Donna Freitas about her book, The Happiness Effect. It's out in paperback now this month. Donna, you tell the story of some students who, because of one circumstance or another, spent time offline. They couldn't go online. And it sounds like, for the most part, they really liked it. They kind of liked it. They felt like the pressure was off. But when you had the choice of voluntarily going offline, easier said than done.
Yes, I was amazed by how many students who brought up without my asking the struggle that they have with their smartphones, with putting them down, but wanting to put them down. So they're, I would say that this generation is thinking a lot about their usage. I think we make a lot of assumptions about them, like they're just sort of like zombies who grab their phones all the time. And I was really amazed by how many of them had all of these little tricks to getting off their phones. Like, they made deals with themselves, like, okay, when I leave the house, I'm going to leave my charger at home. And when my phone's battery dies, you know, that's it for the day. Like, I can no longer use it. And I had a lot of students saying things like this. And then I had a lot of students who, you know, I would catch them, maybe our interview would be shortly after spring break. And, you know, maybe they went, you know, on spring break someone far away, or they went, you know, camping, or they went on a cruise with their parents and their parents said, you can't use your phone because it'll be too expensive. And so, you know, they were without it for a whole week and they had a lot to say about it. They talked about how, what a struggle it was the first 3 days to not be on their phones. And then pretty much across the board, they talked about how wonderful it was once they got through those first difficult days and how they really dreaded coming back to them. And so I would say that overall, the college students I interviewed really had a love-hate relationship with social media and their smartphones. And, you know, they really work hard to curb their usage. I had students who felt, you know, who would get off Facebook periodically if they felt like Facebook was making them feel bad, or Instagram. And so I'm teaching this class this semester called Life Unplugged. It's a first year seminar class. And in November, my students are going to have to unplug for a week. Ooh. I'm taking their phones away and we're going to lock them up in public safety. And they keep coming up to me after class and they're like, you're really going to take our phones? And I'm like, yes, I am. And if you can't handle it, you should drop the class. But like, this is what we're going to do. And I just keep telling them it's going to be character building. So we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, it always works when I tell my kids something's going to build character. That's always a winning argument. We're talking to Donna Freitas, author of The Happiness Effect, How Social Media is Driving a Generation to Appear Perfect at Any Cost. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you hearing the story of your life right now, your relationship with technology and social media? Do you worry about how you are using these platforms, or if you're a parent, how your kids are? What do you notice about the way, so whatever age you are, what do you notice about the way social media changes how you feel about yourself or your relationships with other humans around you? Call 800-642-1234. And you feel like you're a different person online versus offline. Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation now with Donna Freitas, author of the book The Happiness Effect, How Social Media is Driving a Generation to Appear Perfect at Any Cost. That's out in paperback this month. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about the way you present yourself online? Are you careful about what you post and don't post? Have you figured out a way to use social media without letting it distort your happiness or how happy you think other people might be? Do you unplug or take breaks from social media? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Adam is with us in Madison. Adam, hi.
Hi. I just want to say that I have PTSD, and I deleted all social media because it was kind of like a trigger for that. And I've never been happier.
Adam, how long were you on social media before you hit on this decision to get off of it?
Well, since Facebook was available to college students nationwide.
All right, Adam, thanks a lot for the call and for sharing that story. And Donna, that reminds me, you talk about there's not like a one-size-fits-all approach that's going to work for everybody with social media. Some people, like in Adam's situation, might be best off getting away entirely, but there might be different ways to manage it for others.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. It was very rare for me to meet someone like Adam who just completely disconnected altogether. However, there were a couple of students like that. I saw more students who would go in and out of different platforms and in their relationship with their smartphones. But I think the real question for all of us, not just for the generation of students that I interviewed, is, you know, what does it mean to have a healthy relationship with our devices? What does it mean to have a healthy relationship with social media? You know, I don't think these things are ever going away. But, you know, I think that's the question we have to start asking. And I'm not sure we have been asking that. You know, everything is coming at us so quickly. We're all sort of scrambling to try to figure out where we are in relation to it. But I start my class, all of my classes with my students now, asking them this question and trying to get them to think about it all semester, because I really do think it's one of the most important questions of our time.
And you go back to ancient Greek philosophy with some suggestions and a pretty famous line. I think the know yourself was one of the key ways to think about social media.
Well, I think in general, I'm a big fan of critical thinking. I mean, I am a college professor, but I really do believe that we haven't yet, but we need to become critical thinkers about social media and our smartphones. And like, I just had a conversation last week with my students. We talked about the feature on like YouTube and Netflix, where the autoplay feature. And, you know, we talked about how the history of that is that, you know, YouTube put on autoplay and then, you know, there was a ripple effect. Now, like, everything is on autoplay, you know, and we talked about how the reason why companies are doing that and platforms are doing that is they want to keep our attention. And this is a battle for our attention. And my students were like, what? But I thought it was for our convenience. And I was like, no, I mean, it may be convenient, but no. And so they were sort of horrified by that. And I was, you know, these are the kinds of things that I want you to be aware of so that you can make choices around this. Maybe you don't like the idea that, you know, a company is trying to take your attention away, say, from a really good conversation you were having with your significant other. And so maybe you turn that feature off, and that's a decision you make, because you need to start making decisions around this as opposed to just, you know, letting it happen to us. And so that's what I mean by, I think that we need to become critical thinkers in that way, because once we do that, that's when we get back some of the power. And I think that's when we put ourselves in a position to make decisions as opposed to just sort of let the wave come over us.
Let's go to our callers again. Tom is with us now in Baraboo. Tom, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Tom?
Well, you know, I see a lot of cell phone use, you know, more and more and more. And it just seems a lot of times it just gives me this strange feeling that people aren't interacting with each other anymore. I just saw a young couple, and they're probably tourists, you know, it's Memorial Day. But, you know, they're on their phones, and they're not talking to each other. And I'm walking my dog, and I'm enjoying the real world, and they're in this other world. And it happens more and more, and it's just starting to, get creepy.
Tom, thanks a lot for the call, Tom. Is this something you came across, Donna, in talking to all these college students, this worry that they weren't as connected to the real world as they might be.
Oh, yes. I heard it all the time. I still hear it, you know, when I go give talks on campus. I hear it from my own students. And, you know, of course, they talk about it and they complain about it, but then they also do it. So they say that. They admit that. They're like, you know, I hate it, but I also do it. And I think there's just this real struggle with the grabbing of the, you know, of the phone, or just, you know, I just walking around on campus now, or just walking around the city. You know, I live in New York City. You know, at least half the people are, you know, looking at their phones while they're walking. Or if you're on the subway, you know, it used to be that people were sort of all looking around, and now almost everyone's on their phones. And so, you know, I do think, you know, people are frustrated with themselves, they're frustrated with each other, except we have to start making hard decisions or trying to figure out, well, do we really care, you know, about our connection to the real world, or are we just going to succumb? Because, you know, it's on people's minds, they're talking about it, but it's one thing to talk about it, and it's another thing to actually get a hold of it.
Tom, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Donna Freitas, author of the book The Happiness Effect, How Social Media is Driving a Generation to Appear Perfect at Any Cost. Donna, a lot of times I hear two different theories. One is that social media is terrible. Another is that young people today are terrible. Your view on this is a little more nuanced than either of those. There's some positives, I think, you see to social media, and that the kids you talk to, kids, college students you talk to, see in social media.
Well, I mean, I don't, there's, you know, everyone loves to say this generation, or maybe every younger generation, mm-hmm. is super narcissistic and all of that. And I'm not sure that that's true. I don't really think that that's true. I think, you know, they're, like when you try to take in the fact that, you know, this generation, they really are the pioneer generation for all of this new technology, and it's happening so quickly, and we haven't had a chance to catch our breath. And, you know, I think we should hold back in, you know, judging them so harshly. And I also think that, you know, so many of the things that the students I spoke with that, you know, they were struggling with, there are also things that all of my friends are struggling with and everyone I know is struggling with, and they're not in college. So I think we're all in the same boat in many ways. But, you know, there were things that the students really loved. You know, they loved getting to take pictures, even though they also had a complicated relationship with seeing pictures all the time, you know, perfect pictures and happy pictures. But they really loved getting to see photos and take photos. They loved the fact that social media could keep them connected to people far away. They loved that it could help you make plans easily. You know, they love GPS. Like, there are things like that. But I think we do have to ask ourselves, though, you know, there are these really nice features. It's really great to call an Uber. But the downside, I think, is pretty intense. And, you know, I find my own students really on the fence about, you know, whether or not they can manage to find a healthy way through. And I've had a lot of students who have asked since I published the book, you know, is it even possible for me to have a healthy relationship with social media? So I think there is a lot of good, you know, you can be really creative with it, but, you know, we're definitely in that place of struggle right now. So we'll have to see what shakes out.
One trend, Donna, I've seen more recently, I think since your book came out, more people sharing things like their mental health struggles, for example, willing to share that negative or what can be seen as a negative thing in their lives, not that happy picture that a lot of the students you talked to a couple of years ago were willing to do. Is that a trend you're starting to spot?
You know, I really think it depends on how old you are and where you are in life, because I think we've made high school students of a certain age and college students of a certain age acutely aware that anything they post could mean that they don't get into the college of their choice, or they won't get the job that they dream of. And, you know, they're very sensitive to the fact that any comment could just, you know, do them in. So I would say that I think there are maybe moments in life, or even entire periods of life, where that is okay. Like, I know that my friends feel more okay doing that, but, you know, they have jobs, they're established in their careers, and so that's a very different place to share those things. But if you're on the job market, for example, or if you're like a high profile person on campus, or you have some sort of high profile position, I think you're thinking very differently about what you post in that moment.
We'll leave it there for now. Donna, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
We've been talking to Donna Freitas. She's the author of multiple fiction and nonfiction books, a university professor. Her latest book, the one we've been talking about, it's out in paperback as of this month. It's called The Happiness Effect, How Social Media is Driving a Generation to Appear Perfect at Any Cost. Well, if you want to share the story of your social media life, if you have this love-hate relationship with it, we would love to hear from you. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Or use the social media to share your thoughts. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, the Trump administration plans to dial back restrictions on methane, a key contributor to climate change. We'll find out what would change under the new rules and their possible impact. Many schools are dealing with a teacher shortage in some key subject areas. An education expert says there's been an exodus from the profession and we need to turn it around. Plus, cartoonist and author Randall Monroe joins the show. That's all tomorrow on Central Time. Got cash? If you do, there's a good chance you pulled it out from an ATM. And today is the 50th anniversary of the machine that got it all started. On this day in 1969, the first automated teller machine went into action. Wasn't exactly convenient for us here in Wisconsin because it was on Long Island in New York. Bit of a drive. And for the first couple years, all you could do with an ATM was take money out. It was quite a while before you could do deposits and other stuff. Here in Wisconsin, as well as for some reason in Florida and the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, we used to have the unique version of the ATM called the Time Machine with a Y, and it stood for Take Your Money Everywhere. I did a formal, or informal, I should say, survey of people working around the studio on Labor Day today and asked people, have you ever used a time machine? And I think they, you know, thought most of them, any of them who weren't from Wisconsin and of a certain age, kind of thought I'd lost it. But people who grew up here at the right time or moved here, as I did in the 90s, we often got our money from a time machine and would use the word time machine to, you know, refer to an ATM. And one of my colleagues, Michelle, had a trip in England where she was asking the locals where the nearest time machine was. They were a bit puzzled, you know, but, you know, Americans, right? Well, remember those time machines, celebrate them, celebrate the anniversary of the ATM as you pull out cash. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.